to San Remus. In Barashit 7-11, we read that in that day, a great magnitude and quantity of deep ocean water from Tahon and all underground springs from Mayan subterranean cisterns burst and gushed forth, Baka, and the floodgates, Aruba, of the skies, Shamayim, were opened, were Patah. Well, what we have come to learn is that just as in the creation account, every term that Yahweh wielded was precisely accurate. What he said occurred exactly in the order and the way that he described. And at the time that he described. Well, the same is true with the flood. You know, the flood account in the Torah is often set alongside the mythical epics of floods in cultures around the world. Now, there is a difference between this one and the others. And the difference is that this one happens to be true. And it has been proven to be true. I mean, the evidence in the Black Sea, the evidence at the in Earth, the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, the evidence in the Straits of Hormuz, the evidence that exists now with the Burkle impact crater shows that exactly what God said occurred, did occur in the way that he said, when and where he said it occurred. When you have absolute proof that something happened exactly as it was described, it is no longer a myth. A massive asteroid impact in the ocean, this evidenced by the Burkle impact crater, is the only event capable of incorporating all of Tehom's etymological nuances. Deep ocean water roaring up from the depths in overwhelming quantities and force, creating wave upon wave without intermission. The shock wave from such an impact would tend to free all underground stores of water in the region, breaking them loose. And as we know from meteorological modeling, the asteroid strike of this magnitude would release the floodgates of the heavens, causing torrential rains, which would be followed by massive accumulations of snow. So convinced he was that this asteroid was the cause of the flood depicted in the Torah. A scientist commenting on the discovery of the Burkle crater for the History Channel's presentation of it said, quote, "We no longer need God to explain the multiple flood legends," end quote. Well, my friend, you just did the opposite. What you did is verify that God's explanation of the flood was accurate, meaning that it's no longer a legend. Now, Genesis isn't a legend because, well, it has been affirmed. But those who would claim that it is a derivation of the Gilgamesh epic haven't read the Gilgamesh epic. They've taken a couple of lines out of context and said, see, similar, flood, same. Well, they aren't remotely similar. I've read every aspect of the Gilgamesh epic. It is a very, very long story. The story is all designed to explain and introduce each of the gods associated with the zodiac. And it's a travel tale of a god with a human accomplice to meet with the various demented deities of the zodiac, who are flawed individuals in their own right, and the animosity of these various gods towards humanity. There is about a 0.1% overlap and about a 99% disjointed presentation. So 99.9% of the Gilgamesh epic does not coincide, in fact, is the antithesis of the story told in the Torah. So it is 99.9% different. And, I mean, we're talking about the opposite. This is pagan mythology in its rawest form. I mean, absolute stupidity. And there's a 0.1% overlap, and it's only in very, very minor aspects of the story. Moreover, the oldest copy of the Gilgamesh epic is 700 BCE, 700 years after the Torah was written. And, by the way, it would be natural for the Babylonians to tell stories of a flood, because guess where the flood occurred? In Babylon. Now, nearly 4,000 years before man figured out what happened, Yahweh provided written documentation of when, of where, of why, and how the flood occurred, including specific details which wouldn't be completely understood for many millennia. And when every aspect of what he had revealed was confirmed to be correct, man, rather than pointing a finger toward God, poked him in the eye and said, "This removes the need for God to tell us about the flood. We have explained the flood." Keep in mind that this passage isn't the only one in which Yahweh suggests that he will use an asteroid to accomplish something. Speaking of an asteroid having a significant influence. In the 8th chapter of Revelation, God says that he will nudge Balo, using the Greek term that is used in translation, an asteroid that he calls Asbestos, from its orbit, so that it will collide with the Earth. Scientists have labeled this asteroid Asbestos. Apophis. Asbestos is the Greek translation of the name. Apophis is the chosen scientific name, and they've named it Apophis 2004 MN4. But they are unaware of Yah's prophecy, and therefore expect it to miss our planet by a distance of less than 15,000 miles, or by less than a tenth of the distance from the Earth to the Moon. It's projected to be the closest near miss of any Earth-altering event. You know, my guess is that the Black Sea Gazette circa 2968 BCE featured a similar story, predicting that the comet that they saw streaking across the sky would miss them as well. From what I can tell, Asbestos, or Apophis, is of similar size to the asteroid which formed the Burkle crater, supporting a diameter of a quarter of a mile. So the Burkle crater, of course, is 18 miles in diameter, but the asteroid that hit and caused it was probably of similar size, about a quarter of a mile in diameter. There's an Erkomai comings and going chapter of Yada Yah that presents all that is known about this troublesome rock. And scientists know that it's going to arrive on Friday, April 13th, 2029. That happens to coincide to the day of the end of the Magog War. It's about 29 months into the tribulation at that point. So if I were you, I'd make plans to now to skip out of harm's way, join the other members of Yah's covenant family in the Teruah harvest long before that occurs. Now, returning to the Torah's narrative, we learn that within this basin, all, this is now from Bereshit 7:21, all related human and animal flesh, basar, living creatures, especially related people descended from a specific bloodline, or preachers in the case of Bashar, which moved about upon the ground, perished, grasping for breath. They expired and died, including birds, domestic animals, wild animals, and all kinds of small insects living in colonies, scurrying about in swarms on the ground. And every man, Adam. Now, before you pass judgment on what every Adam man means in this context, consider what followed the comma in the previous statement. Everyone who had by way of relationship within their breath and nature a living nesama, a conscience, all with the spirit of desolation died a natural death. We have stated this before, but this affirms it. Yahweh's lament was that he had made humankind special. He had taken a Homo sapien, and he had given a Homo sapien a nesama, a conscience, a seat of judgment, the ability to exercise good judgment, the ability to understand. You know, he said that all animals had a nephesh soul, which is a nephesh soul is our ability as animals to observe the world around us and respond to it. Unlike plants, animals have a nephesh, this ability to observe and to respond. Well, observing and responding does not necessarily make for a perfect companion. And Yahweh was looking for an ideal companion to spend eternity with. And so, if you're God and you possess more than just awareness and an ability to respond, but an ability to think and to reason and to understand, you would want your eternal companion to have the same capacity. So Yahweh gave Adam a nesama, a conscience, the ability to process that which was observed so that we could transition from knowing to understanding. And then once we understood, we could respond. We could engage based upon that understanding. A voyage of eternity through the universe with God will require this transition of knowing to understanding to make it enjoyable, to make it worthwhile, to make it fun. It is the ultimate treasure, really. Being able, for example, to, as we are doing, to examine Yahweh's guidance, to observe His instructions, and then use our nesama so that we can transition to understanding it and then respond to Him. So God has told us here that His target was everyone who had, by means of relationship within their breath and nature, a living nesama. And He then qualified those further. He said, all with the spirit of desolation, of lifelessness, of destructiveness, died a natural death. You see, once you have a nesama, which is a great, great gift, God gave us mortal life, a wonderful gift. He gave us free will, another wonderful gift. And to capitalize on free will, during our mortal life, He gave us a nesama, along with His gift of the Torah, guidance, so we could choose, to come to know Him. We could choose to accept, to embrace the terms and conditions of His covenant, live with Him forever. We could choose to reject Him, but we had the process of the capability of making an informed, enlightened choice based upon this gift of the nesama. But the nesama, when Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden, and they passed on their nesama to other humans, what it did is it caused man to use the ability to understand in a very hostile, corrupt way. And so it's not just those with the ability to exercise good judgment that were the target, but those who carried with them the spirit of lifelessness, of destructiveness, of desolation. And And they said they all died a natural death. Now, the fact of the matter is that that we're mortal. And if we do not use our nesama effectively, if we do not exercise it, and it is it's a skill which you have to exercise. It's like any skill. I like to play golf. If I don't practice golf, I'm lousy at it. You know, LeBron James has a great gift to play basketball, but if he didn't practice it, he wouldn't be the player he is. Well, our nesama, our ability to exercise good judgment, is something we have to exercise. If we wish to go from simply being observant to understanding, we have to actually exercise our seat of good judgment, our nesama, to make connections between things so that we transition from knowing to understanding, so we can respond appropriately to what God is offering. In here, what God is saying is that most of those with the nesama, except Noah and his family, used it counterproductively, and they, as Adam and Chawa had once done, decided that they would league with Satan, that they would accept and advance a corrupt, out-of-context version of Yahweh's instructions. And so they died. And that's the consequence of mortal life. If you don't exercise your nesama appropriately, you're going to die. That's it. It's not a punishment. It's just a natural consequence. Now, someone might say, well, you know, God's being so intolerant and he's such a mean God to have killed all those people. But wait a minute. He gave them their life. You know, how does someone get mad at someone for he gave them what they would not have otherwise had? They squandered it. In fact, the one who gave them life became their enemy. And so he terminated their life. Terminating one's life, if you're the source of that life, isn't a penalty. It's not even mean. Especially when those who you gave life were conducting themselves in such a way that they deprived everyone of the opportunity for continued life. It was the moral thing to do. It was the rational thing to do. Now, since there was no punctuation in Paleo-Hebrew, and a wa, meaning and, so, or, then, is used to designate the end of one sentence and the beginning of a next, there was no wa at the start of the 22nd verse, as it is laid out in most English Bibles, indicating that all of this was one continuous train of thought. God's frustration was with Adam's descendants, who had used their nesama conscience poorly. These people, who had migrated east of Eden, were corrupt beyond hope. So much similar to Christians and Muslims and socialist secular humanists today. Having chosen to associate with the lifeless spirit of satanic deceptions. This realization is one of many evidences that the flood was regional and that it had a specific purpose and that it occurred in this specific place where Homo sapiens with a nesama existed. And when we return in a moment to Shattering Myths, we will consider even more deeply what the consequence and capabilities of a nesama actually are. The nesama is part of mortal humankind, which can know and respond to Yahweh or to the adversary. The nesama is unlike the nefesh. The nefesh is our soul. It makes animals conscious, which means to conscious is just the ability to be aware and to respond. While the nesama, conscience, makes us human. Acting as our seat of judgment, the nesama makes the connection between facts and understanding, between the soul and the spirit. While it does not make us immortal, it provides us with the ability to know, commune with, love, and trust the source of immortality. It is the thing which connects us to the source of life, which is why nesama is based upon nesham, meaning the process of childbirth. But, and there's always a but when it comes to choice, man can use his nesama, the ability to choose based upon processing information wrongly, which is what many of those did who were drowned. That's what they had done. Unfortunately, there would be collateral damage as a result of the flood necessitating the ark. And accordingly, every upright creature there near the surface of the ground was eliminated. Ma'a. Cleansing the earth and removing the impurity that was there because of man. And the collateral damage here. God wanted to cleanse this region of these lifeless souls. And to do that, there would be collateral damage. There would be animals that would succumb to this. But they were eliminated because of man. Meanwhile, domestic animals, which had previously moved about on all fours, and winged creatures which flew in the sky were wiped from the region. Only Noah remained, and those related to and with him in the ark. This is Bereshit 7:23. The moral of the story is that Yahweh has always been more impressed with the quality of a relationship than he is by the quantity of the people that adhere to one. Truth has never been popular. The fact that there are hundreds of millions of Protestants and Orthodox Christians, and over a billion Catholics, a billion Muslims, and a billion Hindus, as well as over a billion socialist secular humanists, it does not make any of them right, much less a godly remnant. We need to appreciate the fact that when Yahweh said that his mercy was available to those who observe, which is to examine and consider his terms and conditions, the terms and conditions of the covenant, and that there were only thousands that would avail themselves of this opportunity, that by telling us and etching it in stone that there would only be thousands who avail themselves of Yah's mercy through observing the terms and conditions of his covenant, that we can do the math. And thousands amongst billions is one in a million. You know, there were eight souls on that ark, eight human souls on that ark. There may well have been 8 million corrupt souls, human souls, in the region at that time. You know, the math may be then as it is now. Now, there are 7 billion people alive today. I would be surprised if there were 7,000 who took Yahweh's Torah teaching as guidance and embraced it, who have come to know Yahweh as he really is, have acted upon the terms and conditions of his covenant. But that's always been the case. That's why Yahusha said that very few find the path to life, which means that if Yahusha was telling the truth and if what Yahweh etched in stone was true, then it's impossible for a religion that is popular like Christianity, like socialist secular humanism, like Islam, like Hinduism, to be the path to life. They are precluded by way of their popularity. So, that's the story. Yahweh chose this man and his family because of the way this man was upright within his family. And this man was upright within his family from God's perspective because he walked with God, because he walked with Yahweh. He engaged with him. And that based upon this, Yahweh created a covenant, a relationship, a family-oriented relationship with Noah and his sons and his wife and his wife's sons, or his sons' wives, for the express purpose of conveying through them the nature of his covenant. You see, salvation, which is what happened with Noah and his family, is a byproduct of their relationship with God, just as salvation today is a byproduct of the covenant. You aren't saved and then you engage in a relationship with God. You engage in a relationship with God and you're saved by God as a result of it. That's exactly what happened here. Yosha is recorded in Matanyah 7:15 and 13 and 14 saying, "Beware of false prophets who come in sheep's clothing, but are inwardly they are ravenous wolves. Because the gate is wide and the way is broad, which leads to death and destruction, and many there are who find and enter through it. But the door is small and the way is narrow, which leads to life, and few there are who discover it." If you want to discover it, you'll find the lone path to life in Yahweh's Torah. It is being told from so many different perspectives, but all is one cohesive story as we make our way through the Torah. Now, in the last chapter, we discovered that Yahweh revealed the location of the Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden, for a reason. He wanted us to know where it was located so that we would understand the story of the flood and find confirmation of his word in archaeology, in science, and we have. Civilization began between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, Eden's most notable waterways. The cities found along its shore and those of the Black and Caspian Seas, including Nineveh, Assyria, Babylon, Ur, and Sumer, represent man's first city-states and nations. Recorded history begins shortly after the flood ends, around 2500 to 3000 BCE. And that's not a coincidence. Well, we've covered this material before. It is especially significant now because it identifies the region which was deluged. This is what Yahweh said about the location of Eden. A river flowed out from Eden to water the protective enclosure. And from there, it separated, becoming four headwater sources. The first of the Pishon from Push. It winds its way through all of the region of Ha'ilah, where relationally there is gold. And the gold of the land, the Beliadim resin, and the precious stones are beautiful. The name of the second is the Kishon. It winds its way through the whole of the land of Cush. The name of the third is the Tigris, which travels east of Asher. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. The Hedekel is the Akkadian, which is the Hedekel was the Tigris, is the Akkadian, which is the original Assyrian and Babylonian language pronunciation of what became renamed the Tigris because of the Greek conquests of Alexander. Likewise, the Parat, which is the scriptural name for the Euphrates or Great River, was the Hebrew term for the waterway the Greeks renamed the Euphrates in the 3rd century BCE, also coterminous with Alexander the Great. Both tributaries of the Tigris began their 1,300-mile trek to the Persian Gulf in the mountains west and southwest of Lake Van in eastern Turkey. The east branch begins its journey 20 miles south of Lake Van, while the western source emerges 200 miles due west of Turkey's largest lake. And just as God said in his narrative, the Tigris River flanked the eastern side of Assyria with the Euphrates on the west. Speaking of the great river Euphrates, its twin tributaries emerge 150 miles northwest and 50 miles due north of Lake Van, the latter not far from the mountains of Ararat. From these places, the waterway travels a great 1,700-mile arc west, east, south, and then southeast to the Persian Gulf. walled in by volcanic mountains, Lake Van, like its neighbor Lake Urmia, which is 100 miles southeast of Lake Van, has no natural outlet and thus is saline, as are now the Black and Caspian Seas. Lake Van is considered to be the largest and deepest lake in the Middle East. Satellite photos depict it as a deep royal blue oasis surrounded by inhospitable, rugged, and desolate terrain. Now, turning our attention to the Gishon, I have every confidence that it is the Eras, known on some maps as the Araxes. This mighty river's tributaries emerge 75 miles northeast of Lake Van. During the century-long Islamic invasion which followed Muhammad's death in 632 CE, the river's name was changed from the Gihon, so that the original moniker is quite similar to that name found in the Torah today. Today, the Eras flows eastward from Turkey into the Caspian Sea. Now, as further evidence for this theory, the Iranians called the 12,000-foot range, which towers above the modern city of Tabriz, the Kushay Dag, or the Mountains of Kush, exactly as Yahweh had affirmed. We'll be back in a moment. So having identified the rivers that flowed to the east, which is the Gishon, and to the southwest, the Parat, and to the southeast, the Tigris, symmetry would suggest that we would be wise to look for one which flows north to northwest from Lake Van. In this regard, the most likely candidate is the Pishon, or the Red River, known today as the Kiliz Ermak Red River. Red is important since Yahweh told us that the Pishon would be known for its red stones. More convincing still is the original name of Turkey's longest river was the Faisanus, which was named after a large bird in the region, confirming that it is worthy of consideration. Most all etymological tools connect ancient names with their modern equivalents by comparing the consonant root, and therefore Faisanus and Pishon share the same P-S-H-N root. Certainly connecting it is a logical conclusion. The Red River's current origin is just under 200 miles west by northwest of Lake Van. But since the Euphrates northern tributary passes less than 10 miles from its source, the original location may have been much closer to Lake Van than it is today. The sliver of separation may have been as a result of one of the frequent volcanic flows that have reshaped this region over the last 4 to 5,000 years. Unlike the three other rivers, the Faisanus flows west and then north before draining into the Black Sea. Neolithic civilizations along the river date back to 4000 BCE, with Assyrian, Bygrian, and Hittite colonies emerging in 1900 BCE. Control of this volcanic region passed to the Tubals, then to the Persians, then to the Greeks under Alexander, before falling to the Romans, the Byzantines, and the Seljuks, Muslims from the Mongolian tribes that later became the Ottoman Empire. It was along the Red River shores that the Turks annihilated 1 million Armenian Christians, creating a river of blood in the aftermath of World War I. Others, specifically R.A. Walker and David Roll, have speculated that the Pishon is the Uzhun. Its tributaries descend from the volcanic ridges east of Lake Urmia, emerging 250 miles southwest of Lake Van, eventually emptying out into the Caspian Sea. While there is no initial P sound, the remainder of the name is similar, and the Uzhun is known as the Kezel Uzhun, or Long Gold River, and as such it fits the Torah's depiction of the waterway meandering through the land of gold. I also suppose it is possible that a volcanic eruption in the area truncated the original source, moving it further southeastward. Putting this all together, however, the tributaries of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers are so well known today, and the headwaters of the Gishon and the Red River emerge within 200 miles of one another, all with Lake Van at their epicenter. This blue oasis, which I think may lie directly over Eden, can be found southeast of the Black Sea and due west of the Caspian. It is important because what now appears to be mankind's oldest civilization is buried beneath the shores of the Black Sea. And archaeologists are beginning to discover that humankind first combined or mixed religion and politics in this very place. So to this end, Robert Ballard, of Titanic fame, he's the fellow that discovered the wreck of the Titanic. On September 7th in 2001, he led a research team, which included Frederick Hybert, an archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania. They were on the Black Sea, searching for the civilization alleged to be buried beneath her shores. And if Yahweh is right in saying that this is where humans with an asama who had become devilish were eradicated some 5,000 years ago, that they should expect not only to find them, but to find these civilizations many hundreds of feet below the current water level of the Black Sea. And sure enough, 500 feet below the surface and 12 miles off the current Turkish coast, a multitude of artifacts were found, including collapsed structures, tools, and carved beams. They were all very well preserved in the oxygen-free deep water. The scientific team identified these as, quote, evidence of an antediluvian pre-flood civilization, end quote.